Phil and Kentaro both graduating this year, by the way. And then a more recent paper with Alex. And also at the end, I'll mention briefly some new ideas that I've been thinking about with a series of people. So as you know, there are many interesting physical phenomena whose behavior is often dictated by the fact that they're interacting many-body systems. And typically, their dynamics is very complicated and involves a large number of constituents. Just as an example, you can think about the QCD quark gluon plasma or a high-TC superconductor. But typically, what we're interested in is the macroscopic behavior of the system, so at large wavelengths along timescales. And fortunately, when you're looking at this particular regime, the system simplifies in some ways, and it has features that are universal. And what I mean by universal is that they're independent of the fine detail of the microscopic description. So even if we still don't understand in full glory all the microscopic description, we can still extract some useful physics by looking at these long wavelengths and large timescales. So as you know, there have been, over the past few years, from ADS-CFT, we have seen the emergence of many methods, holographic methods, to compute certain quantities that are related to strongly coupled field theories. And in particular, we've seen the development of a very strong connection between certain gravitational systems, for example, black holes, and strongly coupled gauge theories. And this is particularly interesting for probing not only the thermodynamic properties of these systems, but also their dynamics. And that's particularly important because, as you know, we don't have many other tools, theoretical tools, available for probing either the hydrodynamic or the dynamical behavior of the system. So in this program, if you want to call it that, it's very important to understand if there are any features that are universal that might apply to realistic systems. So even though we're not studying directly things like QCD, if we can find features that are generic enough, you might hope that they will apply to more realistic systems, whether they are particle physics or condensed matter or any other application. So what I want to tell you about today is one particular transport coefficient, so a quantity that has played an important role in the studies of the hot quark gluon plasma. It's the ratio of the shear viscosity to the entropy density, and the measurement that was done at RIC of 8 over S is significantly lower than any other fluid observed in nature, much lower than helium, much lower than water. Furthermore, as I'll tell you about, there was a bound on 8 over S that was conjectured that told you that 8 over S is always greater than a very simple number. And interestingly, the measurement of the quark gluon plasma 8 over S came out to be very relatively close to this simple ratio.
Was being plotted against what? I couldn't read the axis.
So this is, yeah, sorry about that. So this is a plot of 8 over S in units of 4 pi as a function of temperature. So this is supposed to be shear viscosity to entropy ratio for helium. I think this guy is water, a little bit higher, and then you can barely see it. I think that's, I guess this guy is, this must be water, this must be nitrogen. No. These are just known fluids, helium, water, nitrogen. The RIC measurement is very, very low. In fact, it's somewhere along, you know, so close to zero that you, on this plot, you can't see it. And that was the point. So it has such a small ratio that you can't. It's significantly smaller than any other fluid in nature, apart from cold atoms and things like that. So what I want to tell you about today, since I know that not everybody here is an expert on this, although a couple of you will be bored, is a little bit of the history of why 8 over S came to be so prominent in all these studies, and what we have learned about it from ADS-CFT. And in particular, I'm going to focus on higher derivative corrections to 8 over S. And now, by now, it's well understood that the bound that was conjectured is violated. And I'll tell you a little bit about the features of the violation in some models that are generic in string theory. And then I'll conclude talking about the work I've done with Alex, where we show that a link that seemed to be fundamental, was claimed to be fundamental, between the violation of the viscosity bound and violation of causality is really not a fundamental nature. And I'll tell you why that is so in a by looking at a toy model where there's some decoupling of high energy from low energy physics. However, as we'll see, this phenomenon is actually much more generic than that. So if you look at the Rick experiments, as you know, Rick is really probing the properties of the QCD4 gluon plasma, in particular the transport properties, the dynamical behavior of the plasma. So you might wonder why you're allowed to use conformal field theories to study something about QCD. Well, if you plot the energy density of the plasma as a function of temperature, and here the energy density is normalized with respect to the value it has if the plasma is free, so just a bunch of free gluons and quarks, then you see that right after the deconfinement transition, which is a straight line here, there is a deviation from what should be the value if the system was asymptotically free. So you're not reaching 1, which would tell you that the energy density is that of a free plasma, but you're a little bit below that. So this discrepancy is telling you that, at least in this temperature range, the plasma is strongly coupled, so you're not asymptotically free yet. And of course, later, as you increase the temperature, you approach that line. Another thing to notice is that as long as you're not too far, well, as long as you're not too close to the deconfinement temperature, the bulk viscosity was measured to be small. And the bulk viscosity is a measurement of how much away you are from conformality. And therefore, at least in this temperature regime, the plasma is nearly conformal. So you see that there are some features of this plasma that are really close to the conformal field theory, strongly coupled conformal field theory. And more importantly, there may be properties that are universal. And so if you can extract things that are universal, that are more generic and don't apply to just these conformal field theories, you might use them as input into realistic simulations of the quark gluon plasma. So if you look at heavy ion collisions at Rick that are off-central, so imagine atoms coming in this way, colliding, what was observed is that the plasma after the collision expands in a way that's not as isotropic. So it's very anisotropic and preferential in this direction. And this was called, well, this behavior is called elliptic flow. So the elliptic flow of this system was measured to be very large. And you can then translate information about elliptic flow into information about the shear viscosity of this fluid, of this plasma. And it turns out that it's described very well by hydrodynamics with a very small ratio of eta over s. In fact, so small that this should be considered very close to a perfect fluid. And here I'm just giving you an idea of how close to 1 over 4 pi the results are. This is a paper that's a little bit old, and if you look at the literature, you'll find different ranges for eta over s depending on the choice of initial conditions. But roughly, you know, roughly they're all within, they're of the right ballpark. So a few, at most, a few, you know, small number over 4 pi. So if you instead look at a weak coupling calculation of eta over s, you'll see that the dependence on the coupling lambda is of that form. And so when you're at weak coupling, eta over s is expected to be very large. So if you plot eta over s as a function of coupling, what you find out that at weak coupling, it takes on, it becomes very large. At strong coupling, it becomes small, and then presumably you interpolate between the two. And I'll explain to you in a minute what this straight line is. One reason, one simple way to understand why eta, small eta over s tells you that you're strongly coupled is because you can relate eta over s to the mean free path of particle. And so naturally, when you have, when the mean free path is very small, that is, you know, it's telling you that the system is strongly coupled. And precisely because it's strongly coupled, a lot of, you know, there are useful methods to extract information about it coming from EDFCFT.
P times L, what was P?
P is the average momentum of a particle. So the first, well, one of the important calculations of eta over s coming from ADS-CFT was done for n equals 4 superion mils by Policastro, Swan, and Starinets. And they found this by now famous, very simple result. And a little bit later, Alex and Jim Liu show that this is, in fact, universal in all gauge theories that have a gravity dual that is Einstein gravity, so no higher derivative correction. So this is universal in the limit of infinite coupling and infinite number of colors. And this was independent of the matter content of the theory, the amount of supersymmetry, whether it was conformal or not. So it's a very general result. Also, there was a simple dilute gas estimate that told you, that seems to suggest a lower bound on 8 over S. So if you use just the theory of a dilute, if you assume that this is a dilute gas, then from this simple relation in terms of the momentum and the mean free path, you would deduce that 8 over S might be bounded from below by H bar, roughly. However, keep in mind that this is a big assumption on the state of the plasma, and in fact, it turns out that it's not a simple dilute gas in this regime. But at least there was this suggestion that there could be a quantum mechanical bound on 8 over S. So all these arguments led Compton, Sohn, and Steinitz to conjecture that 1 over 4 pi was actually the lowest value that 8 over S could take for any fluid. And again, one reason why they thought it might be so, other than the ones I gave you a minute ago, is because any other fluid in nature was significantly higher. And also the Rick measurement was at most a few times 1 over 4 pi. So given that 1 over 4 pi is universal in Einstein gravity, so without any higher derivatives, what happens to it if you add curvature corrections? So obviously, curvature correction, yeah.
When you say that it's Einstein gravity, does that mean and not other massless fields?
No, I'm saying it's just, as far as gravity is concerned, it's just R, there are no curvature corrections.
That's the other thing.
Yeah, you could add matter, you could add gauge fields, and then you would always get 1 over 4 pi. So the corrections really come from having gravitational higher derivative terms.
Things like chemical potential or stuff like that would change the black hole.
The chemical potential would still give you 1 over 4 pi, and I'll talk about it later.
But if they have metaphase, would they generate some higher derivative chemicals?
I'm sorry, I missed the beginning.
If there are metaphase, would they generate...
If there are...
Metaphase.
Oh, matter fields. Would they generate?
Would they generate, if you integrate some nested matter field?
No, a matter field still gave you 1 over 4 pi. So it's really the presence of the gravitational curvature terms, the Riemann square.
Well, my question is, if there are metaphase,
yeah,
if you integrate them out, they would generate more higher order curvature terms, right, in general.
Right, so if you generated curvature corrections, higher order curvature corrections that involve, say, the Riemann, you know, really gravitational curvature corrections, then you would modify it. And I'll talk about those corrections.
Well, I think I understand. So if you had massive fields that you integrated out, then that would give you these curvature corrections with the coefficient suppressed by the mass of whatever you integrated out.
Mm-hmm.
So string theory, that's self-confined, I guess.
Yeah.
But if you have massless matter fields and you integrate them out, it sounds like they should dominate because their mass is smaller than the one that you integrated out to get those terms. So is the statement that they don't contribute a classical statement that if you do a classical analysis with these massless matter fields, the black hole will change, but not at the quantum level, which would be the analog of integrating out and getting these curvatures?
Yeah, so far we're talking about classical corrections, yeah.
I guess you can ask the question, what's the effect of the quasi-normal modes, the light quasi-normal modes on 8 over S?
Yeah.
So those are kind of non-linear effects in particle dynamics. And there is some partial information in the literature, but the short answer is that it hasn't been computed. Yeah. In fact, that will depend on the infrared cutoff, because, you know, when you integrate in exactly massless modes.
So the statement that it is universal irrespective of the matter content is at the classical level.
Possible, yeah.
Right. Thinking of this as an effective action that comes, so by definition, effective action is right. And trying to integrate out.
I would resist you on that point about effective actions being classical, but.
Well, I guess.
But
in fact, there are corrections, and there was a paper today where even in a two-derivative gravity, it's not necessarily 1 over 4 pi, but it is a little bit contrived model. So when you have an anisotropic shear viscosities, so when you have a vector condensate, then they can be different. Then you can deviate from 1 over 4 pi, but you deviate towards a larger
All right.
Okay, no more questions. So let's go back to the basics of why we even want to bother with higher derivative corrections. Well, of course, from a effective field theory point of view, we know they're there. Einstein gravity is just a low energy description of string theory. But you also want to look at them from a phenomenological point of view, because you might want to correct things that are measured and bring whatever quantities you can extract from a DSDFT closer to the actual measurement. Of course, on the gravity side, these are curvature corrections, and as we'll see on the CFT side, there'll be either finite lambda or finite length correction. Also, there are known pathologies that are associated with higher derivative gravity. You modify the graviton propagator, there are ill-defined boundary conditions. However, and of course, all these issues are related to the fact you have additional derivative terms. However, these are pathologies that only show up at the Planck scale. So if you think of this as an effective field theory where these are perturbative parameters, you don't have to worry about them. And for example, you can generalize the Gibbons-Lachin boundary term, you can generalize counter terms, and I'll just mention briefly, and I'm not going to talk about it afterwards, one of our papers extended some of the work on these Gibbons-Lachin and counter terms, Gibbons-Lachin boundary term and counter terms, to an action of this type where you have generic curvature square corrections and some gauge field present. And that's all I'm going to say about that paper. I don't know, right, I don't know of. Right.
If you consider terms that have derivatives of the Riemann, those typically you can.
Yeah, that's what I'm saying. There should be also those. And I'm asking if they can see them, because they definitely don't write them in this.
No, my point is that if you put a derivative there, the problem will be generically ill posed.
Well, I think maybe if I add something to what we said. So there, at this level, alpha 1, alpha 2, and alpha 3 are the most general. You're absolutely right, there are derivatives, but there are also field redefinitions.
Yes.
And so you can stop writing the most general stuff, and then you figure out that a lot of them you can remove by field redefinition.
So you're saying all derivative terms you can...
At this order, at the order of when they have, say...
At the square.
Right, at the quadratic order. So that's the most general.
I see.
Also, to dimension 4, the only thing that has derivatives is a box R, and that's a total derivative anyway. So.
Yeah.
Okay, so the first corrections, the people who looked at, like Alex, Jim, Sarinex, they looked at alpha prime corrections in n equals 4 super EM mil. So on the gravity side, this was a DS factor plus 5. And they found that the corrections increase the rate. Oops. Increase the ratio, and this corresponded to alpha prime cubed r to the fourth terms in fact to b. But there were also bound violations that were noted, and there was a group including Juan Myers here, people at MIT and other collaborators, where they looked at, if you like, a toy model or an effective five-dimensional model of Gauss-Bonnet gravity. So Gauss-Bonnet gravity is a special combination of curvature square terms that I form. And they found that the bound was violated, provided that the Gauss-Bonnet coupling was positive. And I'll come back to this in detail later in the talk. There was also a string theory example that was constructed by Katz and Petrov. They looked at ADS Pycos' 5 mod Z2. This is a certain setup. It's a model where you have some D7 brains on top of the standard D3 brain. And what they looked at, again, are these generic curvature square terms, and they found that the bound was violated if the coefficient of the Riemann square term was positive. And by the way, the reason why there is no dependence on C1 and C2 is precisely because those terms can be eliminated by field definitions. And so C3 is really the only physical parameter. So again, notice this comes with a minus sign. So as long as the coefficient of Riemann square is positive, you'll get a bound violation. And the couplings, these guys, can be determined in terms of the matter content of the dual field theory. And in fact, this was noted by first Katz and Petrov, and then explained in much more detail by Alex and the collaborators here. These couplings are really sensitive to the fundamental matter content of the theory, and they're one of our interactions. And also in this paper, you'll find a large class of CFTs of violated bound. So when we got interested in this story, we wanted to ask what happens to 8 over S if you add a finite chemical potential. This is an R-charged chemical potential. Now, at the 2-derivative level, people found that including the chemical potential didn't change the result. You still got 1 over 4 pi. And that's a consequence of the fact that 1 over 4 pi is universal in Einstein theories. However, with higher derivatives, it wasn't clear what would happen. And in particular, you might think that the bound might be restored if you took the chemical potential to be large enough. Also, we wanted to look at curvature corrections that were constrained by supersymmetry. So we wanted to insist that all the terms were related to each other by supersymmetry, and asked what was the role of the supersymmetric completion of these terms on 8 over S. And of course, from the point of view of matching to data, adding a chemical potential gives you one more parameter that you can try to play with to better agree with the actual experiments. So the leading order theory that we looked at is a simple form. So this is equal. This is n equals to gauge supergravity in 5 dimensions. The gauging, as you can see, gives you a cosmological constant. The black hole solutions were studied a long time ago. They're solutions that depend on 2 parameters, the R charge of the charge of the gauge field, and a non-extremality parameter that gives you a temperature. And for those of you who are familiar with the superstar, if you take mu and set it equal to 0, so if you take the extremal case, this is nothing but the well-known superstar solution. And by the way, you can see, one way to see that there's a chemical potential is to notice that if you look at the Gibbs free energy, the charge, the chemical potential is dual to the charge in the standard world. So in this theory, higher derivative corrections kick in at order R squared. This is a statement about the amount of supersymmetry that you have. And they include the mixed gauge gravitational transignment term. Now, we wanted to have a consistent string theory reduction, and we wanted to have all the curvature squared terms that were constrained by supersymmetry. In principle, we could have obtained them by compactifying from 10 dimensions. However, this is rather involved, so instead of doing that, we took a little shortcut, and we made use of a very nice paper by Yuji Tachikawa and collaborators, where they found the supersymmetric completion of this mixed transignment term. So this is a rather technical paper, so all I'm going to say is that this is a nutshell formulation on n equals 2 gauge supergravity. And the bottom result is that what they found was a nutshell action with a variety of auxiliary fields that contained all the terms that were related to this transignment term by supersymmetry. So we took their off-shell action, integrated out all the auxiliary fields, and obtained the Lagrangian of the theory. And the only reason why I bring this up is to point out a couple of features. So here you recognize the Biot square tensor. This is the mixed gauge gravitational transignment term. And everything else are terms that are related to those by supersymmetry. And the strength of these higher derivative corrections is controlled by a parameter. And of course, you can ask, what is the physical meaning of this parameter? And in particular, what does it mean? Oops. Sorry about that. I'll turn off my wireless preview. In particular, you want to ask what it means. Thank you. By the way, I dropped my computer this morning on the floor. So I'm hoping it will make it to the end of the talk. So you want to ask, how can we understand this coupling on the dual gauge theory side? So it turns out that you can relate this coefficient, the strength of the higher derivative terms, to the central charges of the dual field theory. And you can do it in 2 different ways. You can either look at the trace anomaly or R current anomaly. The two are related to each other by supersymmetry. In our paper, we did both, but because it's a little bit simpler, I'm just going to tell you about the trace anomaly. So if you have a 4-dimensional CFT with 1 supersymmetry, the trace anomaly of that CFP is related to certain combinations of curvature square terms. And in particular, sitting in front of these two combinations, you have the central charges A and C. If you repackage the terms so that you pull out the dependence on the Riemann square tensor, you see that it's proportional to this particular combination of the central charges, E minus A. And if you remember from the example of Katz and Petrov that we saw a few minutes ago, in some sense, the Riemann square tensor is sort of the more important term, because you could always get rid of the other two by field definition. And that's a very schematic argument, but you can understand roughly why this guy is the coefficient that is really sensitive to the higher derivative terms. In fact, there is a prescription that was worked out a long time ago that allows you to relate the coefficients of arbitrary curvature square terms to the central charges. And so by using this prescription, you can you find that the coupling of these higher derivative terms is simply related to this combination of central charges, C minus A over A. So now we basically have all the ingredients to see what type of answer we get by correcting H over S with a chemical potential. And you expect to find some small correction to 1 over 4 pi that will depend on the R charge of the solution and this combination of central charges, so the coupling of the higher derivative terms. So to find the entropy, there's a well-known prescription, Wald's entropy formula. The shear viscosity can be extracted by looking at certain correlators of the boundary stress tensor. In fact, if you look at the relativistic stress tensor of hydrodynamics and you allow for some dissipation, you'll see that you find these two couplings, the bulk viscosity and the shear viscosity. And that allows you to extract the shear viscosity from a particular correlation function of this certain component of the stress tensor. And notice that when you extract eta, you're also taking the small frequency limit, and you're looking at large wavelengths. Again, we're in the hydrodynamical approximation where you want long time scales and long, large distances. So this is included automatically in the definition of eta, and it's just a reflection of the fact that you're looking at an effective description of the dynamics of the system. So you're in the hydro regime. So putting all these pieces together, we got the entropy and the shear viscosity. So again, there are functions of the R charge and these central charges. And notice that when you take the ratio, you get a very simple answer. Even though here there was you had some non-trivial dependence on the R charge, eta over S turns out to have a very, very simple dependence on Q. And it's possible that it might be a sign of some form of universality that we still don't understand. So what are the features of 8 over S? Well, first of all, if C minus A is positive, you will violate the bound. Furthermore, the R charge makes the violation worse. You might have thought that you could have saved the violation of the bound by taking a large enough R charge, but it turns out that it's the opposite. No. However, the violation is always small, no matter how large you take the R charge. The reason for that is because if you look at the range for Q, you find that it can't be larger than 2. It's bounded from below by 0. And that translates into a certain bound on 8 over S. So even though you're correcting 8 over S, the correction is going to be small. And there was a parallel paper by Rob and collaborators where they found the same result for a theory with curvature corrections and a chemical potential. However, they did not have the supersymmetric completion. So another important feature to notice is that this is a 1 over n effect. In fact, if you look at the central charge of the theory, for n equals 4 supernal mils, it turns out that the two central charges are always equal to each other. And this is just a restatement, a reflection of the fact that you don't have any curvature square corrections. The first non-trivial corrections come in at r to the 4th. However, in general, the central charges are only equal to each other to leading order in n, and therefore there will be a subleading contribution of order 1 over n squared. Also, these are not one loop effects. Those would be 1 over n squared. They're just there because you have some open string degrees of freedom floating around. For example, if you remember the Katzen-Petrov construction, they had some D7 brains in the background of a D3 brain, and so the open strings will give you this 1 over n contribution. And this is different from the n equals 4 case, where the r to the fourth correction gave you a finite lambda. So also, if you remember, we started from this very complicated action with a lot of terms constrained by supersymmetry. So you can ask which terms contributed to the calculation of 8 over s. It turns out that even though naively just a few terms mattered, you can simplify things even more by playing around with various identities. And it turns out that only terms that have an explicit dependence on the Riemann tensor contribute. It's a very simple result. So 8 over s somehow is picking out only terms that have the container Riemann tensor. And those of you who are familiar with Wald's entropy formula, this might remind you of that. And in fact, there were proposals in the literature to find some sort of analog of Wald's entropy formula for the shear viscosity. So even though we insisted on the supersymmetric completion of these terms, we really didn't need it in the sense that, in retrospect, all we needed were the terms that depended on the Riemann tensor. However, remember, the supersymmetry does control the structure of these couplings and the central charges, so it's not like it's not playing any role. But certainly this was a very large simplification. So before I move on to the last part of the talk, which is a change in pace. Any questions about this?
That's over the dimensions. I'm trying to think. So you've got higher curvature terms. So that's an expansion in curvature divided by the string scale, essentially, in your interaction. And those things, in five dimensions, will dimensionally go like some positive power of mass. So when you get an answer at the end of the day for eta, it looks like everything's dimensionless in that. And so
it's right, 8 over s.
Yeah, 8 over s is dimensionless. So the way C2 comes in, g squared, I'm not sure what g squared is in the
action. G squared.
You get C2 over g squared as a coefficient there. And,
yeah, so there are, yeah, so, right. Let's see if I can go back.
Is C2 dimensionless? Mostly I'm just trying to follow the dimensions in your answer.
Let me see. So this guy is, and then if you trace back C2, I think there's a factor of G, the cosmological constant, roughly. Or you can think of it as the ADS radius of the cosmological constant floating around between the definition of C2 and the definition of this thing.
That's not the string scale, that's a lower scale. That's set by the curvature scale, it sounds like.
Yeah, that is the ADS.
And so in your final formula, So C2 is all your factors are such that the C2 is dimensionless, I guess.
Yeah, so if you want to think of this as C2, yes, that would be dimensionless.
So in
I mean, there are steps that I'm skipping.
Sure, and feel free to skip them. I just, at the end of the day, though, I'm thinking that the argument was that these curvature terms were small because it was a derivative expansion.
Right.
So I'm expecting to see that the corrections you find in 8 over s are also small.
Oh, yeah, sure. I'm sorry. I didn't understand. Yeah, so, right. So the way you see that these are small is because this is a 1 over n expansion, and you're in the large n limit.
In that particular instance, yeah, but in
more general, this would be 1 over n terms or 1 over n squared.
I express it in terms of the CFT, but just purely on the ADS side, I should be able to see that it's small because it's small ratios of scales, right?
Right, so you can think of it as alpha prime. I mean, it's just alpha prime.
Yeah, but alpha prime times some scale, which seems like it's always a string scale. I don't see, the only other scale in your problem is the curvature scale, and I couldn't see where the curvature scale enters into your formula. That's the thing that's puzzling.
So the curvature scale, I'm going to make it out this small dimension forever. So if I remember well, the way we define the C2, okay. Yes, yeah, so
Right, so C2 is got a
greater scale than I get.
Yeah,
that's the
same
square, which is the cosmological constant.
That's what I missed, okay,
yeah.
Thanks.
Okay, any more questions on this one? Okay, so in all the models that we talked about so far, we were assuming, again, we had some perturbative expansion.
These were models that you could think of as coming from string theory. And so the violation of the bound is by default perturbative, and so it's going to be small. But there was a model, this Gauss-Bonnet model that was looked at, where you could ask, you could look at the violation of the bound even for a large value of the coupling. The reason for that is, I'm sure you know, Gauss-Bonnet is really a theory of two derivatives in disguise. And the solutions, the black hole solutions to this theory are known even for a finite value of the coupling. So you could lead to the natural question, what happens to 8 over S if you can take lambda Gauss-Bonnet to be relatively large? And it looks like you might even be able to reach 0 8 over S. So it turns out that for this pure Gauss-Bonnet plasma, this is not the case. And the reason, the way that it was seen is that if you look at the dual field theory and you require that it's consistent, you see that once the coupling lambda Gauss-Bonnet becomes too large, you start having modes that propagate faster than light. So if the coupling exceeds this number, you would have violation of causality. And that restricted how small 8 over S could be, and in particular, it couldn't be smaller than a ratio of that form. Also, the same bound was found in a completely different way by Hoffman and Maldacena by requiring positivity of energy measured by a detector in the plasma. So if you imagine that you're having this plasma, you have some detectors computing correlation functions in the system, and you require that the energy that they measure is always positive, they found exactly the same bounds on the central charges, which translated into bounds on 8 over S. So it looked like the consistency of the Gauss-Bonnet plasma was ensuring a small violation of the bound. And this suggested a link between violating the viscosity bound and violating microcausality or positivity of energy. However, it turns out that this link is not fundamental. And we showed that with Alex by looking at a very slight modification of the Gauss-Bonnet model, where we linked it to a theory where there was a superfluid phase transition. So the idea behind this is very simple, very generic. While things like the shear viscosity or any transport coefficients are determined by the IR properties of the theory, when you look at causality of the theory, you're really looking at the behavior, the propagation of UV modes. The dynamics of those modes is not hydrodynamics, which is the regime of applicability, which is the place where you're extracting 8 over S from. So just to restate this in a little cartoon, so the shear viscosity is a coupling of the hydrodynamical description when you have low momentum and low frequency, particular when these two are lower than any other physical scale in the problem. On the other hand, the microcausality is determined by propagation of modes in the UV. So the CFT lives up here, and the microcausality is determined up there. So you would think that there is a link between these two if you could move freely in energy up and down with nothing weird happening. But if there is something that breaks this trivial flow, like a phase transition at some temperature, then you won't be able to assume that the physics up here is linked to the physics down there. So we looked at a plasma where there is a phase transition below some temperature. This is associated to the breaking of a global U1 in the field theory and the generation of a condensate of an operator. So above some critical temperature, there is no condensate, and then it develops below a critical temperature. And we coupled, we engineered the theory so that you would have a Gauss-Bonnet term with a coupling proportional to this, the value of this operator, so that in the UV at high temperatures, you would have no effective Gauss-Bonnet coupling, and then this would turn on below the critical temperature. And because of this decoupling, if you want, of UV from IR physics, you expect to lose this connection between causality violation and violation of the shear viscosity bound. So as a motivation, we took a model that was proposed by Gubser and collaborators, which is actually a consistent truncation of type 2 district theory, where you have, in addition to the metric and the gauge field, you also have a scalar field dual to some operator. And this operator is condensing below a critical temperature. We took a slight simplification of that model that has the same type of physics. In particular, we simplified the scalar potential. And we added to it a Gauss-Bonnet coupling of this type. So notice that the coupling, the strength of the correction is controlled by the value of the scalar field, as well as another some constant coupling data. So by construction, this type of higher derivative correction would only turn on below some critical temperature. So again, in cartoons, at high temperature, you know, in the unbroken phase, there is no Gauss-Bonnet term. The theory is just Einstein gravity with a U1 gauge field. And on the black hole solution is just an electrically charged ADS black hole. But when you go below the critical temperature, you break a symmetry. You now pick up this Gauss-Bonnet higher derivative correction, and the black hole is developing thinner hair. So what happens to the shear viscosity? Well, if you're above the critical temperature, all you have is the theory of gravity with two derivatives, so you expect to get 1 over 4 pi, and in fact you do. If you're below the critical temperature, if you turn off lambda Gauss-Bonnet, so that what you have is the standard superfluid model, you still don't have any higher derivatives. So even though this is a non-trivial setup, you're going to get 1 over 4 pi, again from universality. When you turn on the higher derivative corrections, what you find is that the problem with causality-violating modes that was found in the pure Gauss-Bonnet plasma is not there anymore. So you don't have any modes that propagate faster than light. And furthermore, you can show that 8 over S can get pretty low and relatively close to zero. But in particular, it goes well below the bound that came from the pure Gauss-Bonnet plasma. So this is a plot of 8 over S normalized for pi as a function of temperature over the critical temperature. So as you see, that as if you push, if you keep decreasing the temperature, eventually you go below this pure Gauss-Bonnet bound, and it looks like you can arbitrarily lower it, even though we didn't show that. So Tc is mu, roughly. So the chemical potential, some number times mu. Yeah, so at... So this is a second order phase. For 8 over S, no, it's just, no, I don't think so, no.
Into 8 over S coming from Gauss-Bonnet coupling, right? It's just, whatever, proportional to Gauss-Bonnet coupling. So in this case, the Gauss-Bonnet coupling is just a scalar condensate to the fourth power.
So there can be some kink.
In principle, true. But because, so the scalar at the second order phase transition behavior at square root p minus tc. That's going to be p minus tc squared in the vicinity of the phase transition.
Any other questions on this? Well, okay. So what we see is that the link between violating 8 over s, or lower, well, correcting the correction for 8 over s, and the causality violation is lost in this particular case, so it's not fundamental. But more importantly, the way you should think about it is that the link that we used to have between 8 over S and the central charges is lost. So if you remember the examples that we talked about a few minutes ago, the correction to 8 over S was roughly of the form of some number that might have depended on the chemical potential or anything else you had in theory, times C minus A over A. In this case, the correction cannot be written in this form. C minus A is zero in this theory. And even if you try to come up with some effective way to measure the central charges are proportional to the coupling of this Gauss-Bonnet term. That coupling is proportional to the scalar field, and the scalar field goes to zero asymptotically. So it's not clear how you would even think about it over S in terms of some effective central charge. So what happens? Well, so we used to think that there was some link between 8 over S and causality, a link between 8 over S and the central charges. But really, these two links are not fundamental. What is fundamental instead is the link between causality and the central charges. But that, in some sense, is a field theory UV statement, and so it's expected, it's natural. But there was no reason to think that this type of links would be there, since 8 over S is really an IR quantity, and these are UV quantities. So over the past few months, there have been several different papers that, in different ways, have tried to refine the notion of Wilsonian RG flow and apply it to ADS-50. So even though in our construction, 8 over S doesn't run in any Wilsonian sense, it still has different behavior at high and low temperatures. And one question that we might ask is there another way to get some non-trivial behavior for 8 over S that doesn't involve this particular construction? And also, can you understand maybe if there is a lower bound on 8 over S or if there isn't, just the generic behavior, the shear viscosity, by using the framework of some of these papers? For example, in this Pochinski paper and the one with Hong Liu, a collaborator, what they're really studying are the effects of double trace operators or relevant deformations of the CFT, and you might, which trigger our G flow. And were also shown a long time ago to cause the central charges to run. So you might think that this would be a natural way to try to understand what's happening to 8 over S. So let me wrap up. So now, by now, we all understand that ADS-CFT has proven to be very powerful, not just to understand, to probe the features of quantum gravity, but also to explore strongly coupled systems. And it's important to understand how much mileage we can get out of just theories of gravity to probe field theory systems that are actually realistic. And in this program, it's important to have relations that are universal, that are generic enough that they can apply to a variety of setups, specifically because you can use them, at the very least, as inputs into realistic simulations of real systems. As far as 8 over S is concerned, we've seen that higher derivatives corrections typically have this sort of form. So they're either finite lambda or finite n corrections, depending on which parameters you turn on, like a chemical potential, you can have more quantities to play with and try to match the data. But on a more fundamental level, what's happening to the viscosity? Why have we lost the universality of the viscosity to entropy ratio? So, first of all, there's no question anymore that the bound is violated. But with corrections, it's not clear anymore whether 8 over S is universal. It seems hard to extract universal features, at least at this stage. Also, the idea behind this example of the Gauss-Bonnet superfluid is rather generic. All we're saying is that the transport coefficients or the transport properties of the fluid are really a feature of IR physics. But if you're looking at things like central charges or the causality, you're really looking at UV. So there is no fundamental reason for why these two should be connected in any trivial way. So even though these microscopic constraints, whether you're looking at positivity of energy or causality, which of course are related to each other, although they're important for the consistency of the plasma, they're not responsible for setting the lower bound on 8 over S. If there is a lower bound, it's not clear, but what we know for sure is that these constraints are not setting it. So let me stop there.
Yeah, I understand the conclusions. Are you saying that because eta over S is in an IR regime and the causality things are in a UV regime, that we cannot trust the corrections people have computed to eta over S? Or are you saying we can trust the corrections but not the constraints on the corrections due to causality?
Well, I'm not saying you can't trust the corrections. You can definitely trust the corrections as long as they're good corrections or perturbative corrections.
I'm just saying that you shouldn't think that you can relate those corrections to the causality of the theory.
You can trust the corrections, but you can't trust constraints placed on them due to causality.
Right.
Is that's basically
yes.
what you're saying.
So the causality, there is no trivial relationship between the two.
So this 9/10 or was it 9/100 I guess, or something? Of
something like that.
Lambda
so that
GV,
was in some sense,
that's not relevant. You know.
But for that case, I mean, it was correct for that particular case, but it was an accident that it worked out. It worked out because there was no, that in some sense you could move from the IR to the UV in a trivial way because there was nothing in between that kept you from relating those two. It was a trivial theory in some sense. But in general, if there is something like a phase transition, maybe that's not the only way to do it. If there's some non-trivial behavior in between that flow, there's no reason to think that those two things are related to each other.
Well, can I probe you a little bit on that? In the effect theory, there is a well, more or less the statement about these coefficients of these curvature terms being small, you could phrase that as a causality or unitarity constraint in the low energy theory, because if you had calculated other things, you know, and how they depended on these higher derivative corrections, you would have eventually found that things like graviton coefficients would start to blow up on you in a non-unitary way if you got the scales that were too large. And so that identification of a cutoff in the low energy theory implicitly is limiting. If you try to dial, supposing you try to dial all these effects to be big, and your coefficients of the, say, the Gauss-Bonnet term to be big by ramping up the coefficient, then because that was being suppressed by the curvature scale divided by the string scale, then it seems like you'd be forcing yourself to put the curvature scale up towards the string scale, and then you would be expecting things to go better.
Well, okay, so there, I don't know. Maybe I'm not quite understanding the question, but you could, so one complaint you could be that Gauss-Bonnet is just not a good model to look at, that you really should not crank up the Gauss-Bonnet coupling. So even from the gravity point of view,
yeah.
Right, so that is certainly, you can say that, yeah. But I think, yeah, I mean, that's why I said that, where is it? See, this link is really more fundamental because here you're really looking at the field theory side where you know things are under control. And you can relate the causality of the theory to, you can put bounds on the central charges just by doing field theory calculations that you can trust. And that's how Hoffman and Maldacena dealt with that. But then as soon as you crank up the coupling to be large on the gravity side, it's not obvious. But again, Gauss-Bonnet is not straightforward because it is a theory of two derivatives. So I think there are both sides of the argument.
At all possible higher curvature terms, you wouldn't have had a causality issue from the point of view of effective field theory anyway. So the specialness of the Gauss-Bonnet wasn't doing anything for you from the point of view of effective field theory. So then, you know, if you had put in all possible curvature terms, you could have made the same argument, but then it would have been easier to see that there's a problem if you try and dial these things up to higher energies.
So forgetting about the problems of Gauss-Bonnet gravity, think of this as a toy model that's telling you that this just is not, that these two things have nothing to do with each other. 8 over S is an IR feature, causality is not.
I want to look at causality in the CFT side where I'm making contact with things in the UV. Then I take your point that it's hard to make the connection. But I could ask, but it doesn't mean I can't find a causality expression in the low energy theory itself.
Mm-hmm.
And then it's not so clear that the link has been broken there, right? But the only way I can think of phrasing that concretely would be to say that my causality constraints or my unitarity constraints in the low energy theory are going to effectively be the validity of my semi-classical expansion and it's assuming these higher derivatives are small. And then, but as long as I'm in the regime where that's valid, then it seems like I'll have causality will hold. And, so I'm not going to...
Yeah, that's fine. However, that's fine. I think then I would say
even if, let me agree with you, but then let me say that this is not true anymore, even if lambda gauss Bonnet is perturbative. And I think that's a stronger statement. So theta over s in this model is not described by a correction like that, no matter how small lambda gauss Bonnet is. So there is something going on that is not captured by the standard lore. I'm not sure how to get around that.
Captured it, I thought, was that the calculation you did was you calculated that you designed the system so that you had this effective curvature squared term, if I understood you right, and then.
But it doesn't have to be, you could take it to be small.
Yeah.
You could just take it to be alpha prime. You would still find that eta over s would change. So you still find a correction to eta over s, and you cannot explain that correction in terms of central charge.
That's because you're trying to take that step to the ultraviolet, which I'm happy to grant you the point that you can't do. But the more general statement that there's no information that you're getting from causality and unitarity and the Lorentz theory is the thing I'm resisting. That may not be the way to express this in terms of the ultraviolet theory where you're relating things.
Okay, but I understand what you're saying, yeah. But the thing that puzzles me more is the fact that I can't describe the system anymore in terms of central charges. And therefore, you can ask, what is the dual? Is there a dual of this system, and what is it? And that's why I think the one way to do it is really to try to understand this, work in the framework of this Wilsonian RG flow and see what happens. And in the case where you have phase transitions, it hasn't been worked out. And the only thing that comes closest to it is a paper by Song, a few months ago, where he tried, it's a step in that direction, but it hasn't been done. So I think if you do that, then you'll see exactly what's happening. You might see what's happening. Maybe Alex has a different
answer. I guess, so you can compute what causality means, right? So you look at the spectrum of your fluctuations in this area, and you see, are there any fluctuations that propagate faster than the speed of light? So I can do this non-perturbative fluctuation, say, in the exact theory, or, at least, and I will find out in the models that we're discussing, there are no fluctuations that propagate faster than the speed of light. Even though the eta over s, I can dial it, it looks like as low as I want.
But that's not, I guess the thing, I agree with all that, but I think that there's other things you'd also check to make sure you have a sensible Lorentz theory beyond that.
Right. So in particular, it's much more what I believe is happening is that what controls eta over s are instabilities in the plasma that arise. So that's what happens, I guess, in condensed matter physics. So there are, and that's what kind of would likely put some bound on eta over s. And in some models, we do see instabilities, but not in this model.
Is it fair to say that all these calculations are being done in the perturbative regime for the higher curvature terms, and so you find that there's a correction that's perturbative whose sign is not constrained, and then essentially if there was a bound, you can't tell because you're in perturbation theory.
If you are doing string series, that's why this you can think of this as a model. It doesn't come from a string series, but in this model you declare this is my quantum field theory. Okay, so it's defined by a gravity in principle. You can compute all the correlation functions and declare my CFT. I mean, it's still CFT, even though, there is a superfluid phase transition. So you define, this is my theory, and in that theory, there is no, you can dial up the coupling constant beta to whatever you want.
Well, that's the thing I was just
Except for, definitely there are no problems in the UV, but where the problems could be is that there could be an instabilities, and I agree with you. In the infrared. So as you start going to very low temperatures, well, you keep that coupling very large, so there can be various effects. I mean, like, in condensed matter, we know that ground states can be very complicated. So something like that can happen here as well. And so it is very likely that it is, this infrared physics that...
Well, I guess I don't see anything wrong with that, but I think there's a third thing that could also have been going wrong, because I guess I would resist the assertion that you can take these curvature squared terms and dial their coefficients to be arbitrarily large in a consistent way in the in the effective theory, that you'll just find that that.
I agree, yeah. But that's why you should not think of this as an. You should think of this as a full. So that by definition, that's a toy model, and there are no further corrections.
No, but because it's an out-normalizable model, and I think probably part of it is the difference is going to be that you're thinking about it being classical theory, but
right.
But I think that's not fair. I think really the duality is it's a quantum theory, which still makes sense, but there's it's an approximation that you're making, and that the quantum corrections will carry within them bad news, which you could also see classically if you look at other processes like Gravitons scattering or something. There's really a low-energy approximation going on there that you can't violate, and that's...
But I think then the thing, I mean, you could then say... And I know you're not interested in UV, but you know, the good causality arguments, the relation between the central charge and the causality arguments are done in the UV CFP. And what's clear here is that no matter how small or large lambda Gaussian is, doesn't matter if it's large or small, you're not going to have central charges. Yeah, sure, but, yeah.
Is done perturbatively in this thing. You know, it could be that you're looking at a function which does have a minimum, but you just can't see it because you're always working a linear order in the perturbation. Is there any kind of evidence outside of a linear calculation for there being a bound?
No, I don't know.
That's
putting in, no. But again, I guess I want to sell this point of view. I think that something like that will be the right way to look at it. But, yeah, so. Now, if you're doing things perturbatively, how are you going to find out if it's bound?
Well, how this kind of transport property changes on the RT flow, say, if one CFT flows from one UVC to another IR.
Right, so there is some. Okay, so that's the point. That would be the point of this line of work. So right now, so for example, 8 over S doesn't flow in any way in any of the setups that have been looked at. It's sort of an IR property. It doesn't flow. But you could ask what happens if I start adding some relevant information, and this, you know, these guys are looking at double trace operators. And what does that, how does that change the dynamics and the hydrodynamics? The only work, so there's some work on running central charges, for example, Rob Myers here and collaborators. Some ideas coming from that, but as far as we know right now, there is no running of it over us.
But in your examples for fluid, it becomes smaller than the UV.
Well, I guess what I mean by running is that if you write down, there's a way to write down, there's a radial flow equation you can write down for eta, more or less. That radial flow in the low energy, low frequency limit is always trivial. So it's trivial up here and it's trivial down here. So what you would think of the radial flow in the RG sense is trivial.
I'm thinking about two CFT that is connected by RG flow.
Right.
And I'm interested in computing A over S at these two fixed points.
So there is work by, I think the only people looking at it so far are Rob Myers and Inda Sinha. So you can think about it that way.
Okay.
But A over S is sort of it's a property of the IR. So.
I can ask for IR property in both CFTs before
the same.
Yeah, before turning on this double trace deformation.
There would be the same thing. Yeah.
It's going to be 1/4 pi. As long as you are just turning on a double trace deformation, but you're not introducing higher derivative corrections. One problem is that which is related to before the, if you start introducing high derivative correction, it's difficult to set up a Cauchy problem for, you know, for your fluctuations, right? At a, you know, at a finite level. That's why all the high derivative corrections, if you're introducing this, by definition, have to be perturbative. So as long as you can do whatever, double trace, triple trace, deformation, as long as you do not generate higher derivative corrections, as long as your equations of motion are two derivatives, then 8 over S as a UV fixed point is going to be the same as 8 over S as a IR fixed point. It's going to be 1 over 4 pi.
But you could think of coupling something to higher derivative terms.
Yeah.
And then...
you have Riemann squared, but it's not Riemann squared, but it's Gauss-Bonnet, so all the equations of motion.
Yeah.
You're right. So
I mean, you could take Riemann squared, stick something in front of it.
Yeah, I could make a suggestion, because obviously many sessions, and that's fantastic. So thank you, Sarah, again, for inviting us.
Thanks.